Welcome to the Common Good Podcast, a conversation about the significance of place, eliminating economic isolation, and the structure of belonging. This is Joey Taylor, the producer of the podcast, and on this episode, we explore Greg Jarrell's new book, Our Trespasses, White Churches and the Taking of American Neighborhoods. This book uncovers how race, geography, policy, and religion have created haunted landscapes in Charlotte, North Carolina, and throughout the United States. Greg traces the story of the North family, who purchased a home after the Civil War in the historically black neighborhood of Brooklyn in the city of Charlotte. Today, the site of that home stands tucked beneath a corner of the First Baptist Church property on a site purchased under the favorable terms of urban renewal campaigns in the mid-1960s. By carefully tracing the intertwined fortunes of First Baptist Church and the formerly enslaved North family, Greg reveals uncomfortable truths with which we all must reckon and explores how we might heal these hauntings. To celebrate the book's release, we at Common Good invited a handful of friends from around the country to hear some excerpts from Greg's book, to discuss the implications of the book for our own neighborhoods, and to listen to some amazing live music from Don Anthony and Troy Kahn. This event was facilitated by the incredible Courtney Napier. One important note before we begin. In Greg's initial reading, he references a famous photo, which is the cover art for this episode. Later on in this episode, people discuss photos they brought of their own neighborhoods, which you can find in the show notes. Don and Troy kick us off with an opening song called Jesus, Children of America, and then Courtney welcomes everyone.
Jesus, children, Jesus loves you. Jesus, children, hello, children, Jesus loves you, of America. Are you hearing what God's saying? Are you feeling what you're praying? Are you hearing, praying, feeling? You say inside, oh, you better tell your story fast, 'cause if you lie, it will come to pass. Oh, tell me, holy, holy roller, standing for everything you talk about.
One more time.
Tell me, holy, holy roller, are you standing like a soldier? Are you standing for everything you talk about?
Welcome, everyone, to this incredible time together with none other than Greg Jarrell, accomplished author, second book now, Our Trespasses, White Churches and the Taking of American Neighborhoods. We're just so excited to be here to celebrate the release of this incredible piece of literature and to share space together to do exactly what I think, Greg, your book was intended to do, which was gather people to have conversations about how this is affecting their own communities and to mobilize folks in their imagination and in their action. So you want to share a little bit about that, and as well as you're going to read a selection from the book as well?
Hey, thanks, everybody. It's so great to see some friends and some new friends out there. The book follows a particular story from urban renewal, sort of set at one street corner in Charlotte. It's a street corner that I think is emblematic of the entire country that we live in. And so I've tried to dig as deeply as I can into that one little slice of story. And we're going to have a couple readings and some discussion among us about that. So this first reading that will sort of get us into our conversation here, this photograph sort of became the obsession that over the course of almost 6 years finally turned into this book. So from the book, there's a photograph well known in Charlotte that crystallizes urban renewal at one key moment. In it, a man sits on a bulldozer. He is wearing a suit. He is ceremonially driving the bucket of the dozer into a house. The post supporting the corner of the house buckles under the weight of the machine. A dozen compound fractures form where the house's frame bursts through the siding that had protected its family from storms. A photograph is an artifact. It raises the possibility of a haunting through the way it remains recognizable and yet distant. The house in the photo had an address, but the viewer knows that to locate the address and to walk to it in the present day, were that even possible, could never reconstitute the same scene. The landscape is different now. At the same time, the machinery is familiar, as is the shape of the house and the man in the suit and the cloud of dust. From their own places, nearly everyone has known the reality of this photo, some in the operator's chair, others just outside the frame, observing. When photographs appear in context of hauntings, they become part of the contest between familiarity and strangeness, between hurting and healing, that a ghost is registering, Avery Gordon, a sociologist, says. A photograph alters the boundaries of linear time. It is not only evidence of what happened, it also creates a collision of what is past and what is present, what is personal and what is systemic. The photograph describes the future that is always arriving until we resolve the hauntings. The picture of the man on the bulldozer implies all kinds of sounds, but the photograph itself is silent. Often in its public presentation, it is, as well, a display of immense power without the words that might destabilize that power. One set of words that might provoke: the story of the man in the suit. His name is Raymond E. King, Jr., chairman of the Charlotte Redevelopment Commission. He was the county's most important Democratic operative in 1970, a man of enough national importance to be invited to the White House for talks on civil rights by the Kennedy administration and the Democratic National Committee. A good liberal, plowing down houses. King was a deacon at Charlotte's Trinity Presbyterian Church, and a popular Sunday school teacher there. The photograph was taken on a Tuesday, 2 days after King's last Sunday school lesson, 5 days prior to his next one. A faithful Christian working in silence. Many people are excluded from the photo. Perhaps they are just beyond the border of the shot. Maybe the family who belonged to that house is looking on. A photo is an invitation to watch, but it has cropped out those who cannot bear to look. Many of them had questions, surely, about what was happening and why then. The photograph leaves those questions open in perpetuity. The house does not look empty, or at least not like it had to be empty. The disrepair seems to have arrived at the same time as the bulldozer, seems to have been imagined by some officials, seems to have been determined unresolvable just before the photographer opened the aperture. The boundaries of the photograph are arbitrary. There's a ceremony and the picture and the flattening, and that evening Ray King in his suit probably sat on his back porch, a pitcher of tea nearby. "How was your day, honey?" his wife would have asked as she patted the dust off the back of his tailored jacket.
My daughter fractured her wrist last week. She's racing her brother home from school, and the very, very competitive little girl that she is, she ran up the stairs and tripped and landed on her hands just outright. And she screamed the most shocking scream. And as I'm looking at that photo, that's really all I can think of is when you said the fractures, the multiple fractures in the house as the bulldozer is pushing into that structure and what that could have sounded like. I would love to just hear a little bit from you about what came to your mind when you first came across this photo, and what's the story of even finding it?
This photo has been used a lot around the city of Charlotte. In some ways, it captures the essence of what was happening with urban renewal, this kind of brutality that was dressed up in a suit. All the paperwork gets signed, right? Everything's done according to the law. But at the same time, I found myself kind of hesitant that just the display of this photograph kind of memorializing what had happened in some ways kind of reinforces the power that's there. Because the boundaries are arbitrary. And there's a whole series of pictures from that day where you can see other people standing around. So even in the retelling of the story, the boundaries have been drawn so that really important parts of it are left out. So when I started digging around, I started tracking the story of a different family in a different house. But again, a very similar kind of story, a Black family whose ancestors were born enslaved on plantations in North and South Carolina, whose home was taken from them. And the way the story goes is that the city eventually sold off their land, along with a lot of other people's land, to the white First Baptist Church, who built a sanctuary right on top of the former home of this family called the North family. That church sits directly adjacent to the city and county government center here. So it's sort of this symbolic way that the map was rewritten that reinscribed yet again kind of the fusion of political and theological power in making the cityscape. That photograph really kind of gets at the nugget of that. Not just the photograph, but the way that it's used that seems to kind of reinscribe that power rather than destabilizing it and offering some other possibilities.
As you were learning more and more stories about what was occurring around this singular image, what I think you did is start uncovering some of these voices of those who are often rendered voiceless by the dominating histories of how we tell the stories of our neighborhoods, how we tell the stories of our institutions. And how did that challenge the frame of the photo for you as you started to gain more narrative and more reflection and more of the story from the folks who were being impacted by it on the ground?
The sort of the recounting of this period of history locally, and I think oftentimes nationally, often the recounting just sort of assumes that we know the arc of the story. We know what urban renewal was. We know who it harmed. We know what the result was, urban highways and large infrastructure projects, that kind of thing. But less often do we know the intimate details. So what were the lives of the specific families that were hurt, and how does it continue today? So that was part of the project, tracking down descendants. And at the same time, how has the accumulated advantage of that time period, how has that persisted and been covered up? So part of the story for me at First Baptist Church of Charlotte, which let me in a little bit, was that they didn't know their own history. And especially this chapter, even in their written historical documents, they had really covered this up. Basically pretended that it didn't happen and sort of moved on to another piece of their story. So to me, I felt like knowing the intimate details of one specific plot was a better way into the story than just kind of painting it with a general arc.
With a background in journalism, I come across that difference, and I like to think of it as, you know, you have these institutional histories and then you have human histories. And it's the humanizing histories and the humanizing details that personalize these stories and stir our emotions and therefore evoke a response. I feel like a lot of times the institutional stories that we're told don't evoke much response. Like you were talking about, we know about urban renewal, we know who it harmed, we know who benefited in this very kind of high level intellectualized way. And it comes off to me as just information, you know, it's just like, I just have this information now, it's good to know, right? Like you go into a place, it's good to know. But then when you start to uncover those more intimate human stories inside of the institutional story, it evokes our emotions and therefore it evokes a response. Like it pushes us towards a response.
That's exactly right. Part of what I hope the details can do, especially sort of bringing them forward into this current moment, is to suggest that we can respond. Like the power of the bulldozer or the interstate highway that's in the former Black Wall Street, as so many of these places are sometimes called, it seems so permanent, as though we can't really respond. We can't repair the harm that's done. But we still live inside this story. It wasn't that long ago. And it still kind of dominates the way that we interact with our cityscapes today. A spiritual teacher of mine when I was in seminary used to say, the thing that is the most personal is also the most universal. Like if we can really dig down into this, then we might discover that it is possible for us to repair some of the damage some of the material damage that's been done to Black families, some of the spiritual or soul damage that happened that created the narrative that made these actions possible, because that stuff still lives with us as well.
As Greg pointed out, we're here to have a discussion among ourselves, what this book means to us and these topics that we're bringing up around personal versus institutional stories, challenging the frame of the photos of our own communities. And so I would love to pose a question, and then we are going to go into breakout rooms and discuss together. Everybody has something important to share, and I look forward to you all getting into this. So share the photo that you brought with you of your place or neighborhood and talk about what's being excluded or made invisible by the boundaries of the photo.
At this point, people were placed into breakout rooms where they shared the photo of their neighborhood and talked about what is being excluded or made invisible by the boundaries of the photograph. Before we listen in on a small group discussion, we're going to hear a live performance of the song Lonely House from Don and Troy. As they perform, you're invited to find a photograph of your own neighborhood, maybe on your phone or after a quick Google search, and consider what's being excluded or made invisible by the boundaries of that photograph. Here's Don and Troy.
At night when everything is quiet, the old house seems to breathe a sigh. Sometimes I hear a neighbor snoring. Sometimes I hear a baby cry. Sometimes I hear my staircase creaking. Sometimes a distant telephone. Then the quiet settles down again. This house and I are all alone. Street, lonely town. Funny, you can be so lonely with all these folks around. The night for me romantic. Unhook the stars and take them down. I'm lonely in this lonely house, in this lonely. Now
we're going to jump into a breakout room with Greg, Leslie Ann, Paul, and Daniel. You can find the photographs of their neighborhoods in the show notes for reference.
Introduce yourself real quick, and then we have the prompt. Help us shape this.
I'll go. My name is Leslie Ann. I am an assistant minister at Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, New York. And I've lived in Brooklyn for just 2 years now, and in New York for 7.
My name is Paul Sparks, and I'm from the Hilltop Tacoma neighborhood, and I have an amazing gift of being in the same place. I live 2 blocks from where my great-grandmother lived, and my grandfather taught high school here in this neighborhood, and so I have amazing privilege to be in this same context, and I'm still overcoming that amazing song we just heard. That was something else. So, Daniel.
Good to see you, Paul. I live in Cincinnati in the North Side neighborhood, and former pastor and a entrepreneur and coach and consultant right now for Changemakers.
So you were to bring with you a photograph of some sort or a picture that you can share, so maybe somebody can jump in, talk a little bit about the boundaries of it and what's excluded, what's inside it. How are you interpreting that?
Okay, this is a picture of my block. You can't see the house that I live in. We live on one floor of a four-floor home that has been divided up into apartments. I live in the Clinton Hill neighborhood of Brooklyn, which we live very close to the boundary line. On our side of this photo is Classen Avenue. And Classen Avenue is the dividing line between Clinton Hill and Bed-Stuy. And it is right where gentrification is in full force right now. You can see in this photo the abandoned building on the right, which is very actually surprising because the development happening in the neighborhood is intense. And it's surprising that these buildings are still just empty and boarded up and nobody's looked at them. This neighborhood is unique. I feel like Brooklyn and New York in general, the neighborhoods have a character to them. You can look around and the buildings all kind of have the same character throughout the neighborhood. What you can't see in this picture is that Clinton Hill is one of those where you'll have like a 1850 mansion and then right next door to it, a 2010 high-rise development. And down the street, a old Baptist church. Most of the churches in our neighborhood are Baptist. There's also a shelter in the neighborhood. It's just a very diverse neighborhood. And I think that when you look around, you can tell probably that the stories of the neighborhood versus development are happening all the time. We have a neighbor named Dale who lives to the right of this photo and has lived in the neighborhood for a very long time, takes care of people's trash, is hired to kind of take care of people's yards and trash. And he owns his home and has just finished months in court with a developer who is building next to his home and trying to use his wall as like part of their foundation or something. So it's a constant fight in our neighborhood.
Okay, I'll jump in then. So this question, Greg, that you have offered, what is not in the frame? Such a rich and profound and provocative question to think about all the ways that we create frames and what gets excluded from those frames. It's just such an important, rich question. I look at my street. This is the main street of my neighborhood. Through much recent debate, it still maintains its historic name, Martin Luther King Jr., but it has gone through a lot of tenuous debate, and the neighborhood itself has been amalgamated into the greater downtown Tacoma. And so if you were to look up maps, what you can't see from this photo is that Hilltop neighborhood is now no longer has its own neighborhood council, no longer essentially is an identifiable neighborhood of Tacoma, but it has been sort of co-opted into the larger region of what they call New Tacoma, which if you were to travel down just a few blocks from this hill, you move from a very diverse, predominantly diverse community to high rises and white wealthy parties and who now make up the vast majority of the neighborhood council and that sort of thing. You can see that there are no signs evident other than a small image on that mural. There's no signs of the First Nations indigenous peoples of the Puyallup tribe who were here. There's no signs in this photo. Well, there's a repainted building. The purple, orange, blue building there is new. But outside of that, through the pandemic, the light rail, which you see that light rail train, came in through the main street. And from my house in a three-block radius, there are 13 new buildings that came up, new buildings through the pandemic. And this was a time when our neighborhood had very little capacity to essentially gather together in some way to talk about what's coming in and what could be the shape of its future. And how would the people who already are here participate in that? And so a lot of things were really pushed through that time. So that's not in this image either. I'll say one quick other snippet, and that is that on the right-hand side, you see sort of a blue and a turquoise strip on a building there. And right behind that is something called TUPOC, which is the Tacoma Urban Performing Arts Center. And they actually have done an incredible job of essentially inviting the question of who was already here and how can we highlight, strengthen the voice of the parties that are already here. So that's an interesting and more, I think, delightful thing that's going on. So, Daniel, I'll turn it to you.
Daniel, you got to talk fast. I think I just saw a message that we've got a minute or so.
This is the Northside neighborhood. It used to be called Cummingsville until they installed the interstate, but it separated Cummingsville into Northside and South Cummingsville. South Cummingsville has a significant Black population. Northside is known for welcoming gay and lesbian persons. It's very artistic. There are a lot of restaurants here. I think it's been called the Brooklyn of Cincinnati, but it's not Brooklyn. But yeah, there's definitely diversity here, but it's not necessarily connected and working together in a number of ways. But yeah, this is the main drag, and I live down by that second light to the right.
Man, I wish we could hear more from you, Daniel.
Join us next week to hear more from Daniel and to conclude this conversation about Greg's new book, Our Trespasses. In the show notes, you can find more information about the book, Courtney, Leslie Ann, Paul, Daniel, Don, and Troy. This episode has been produced by me, Joey Taylor, and the bumper music is from Jeff Gorman.